Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, the Mueller Report has national and international implications, as well as new developments in North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela. On Thursday, April 18th, Bob Barr, Trump's attorney general, released special counsel Robert Mueller's final 448-page report on Russian meddling in the 2016 election. During a press conference held an hour and a half before even Congress or the public were able to see the heavily redacted report, Attorney General William Barr whitewashed its findings. He repeatedly declared that Trump had been cleared of collusion. Well, actually, the charge was never collusion. It was conspiracy, saying Mueller's investigation did not establish a conspiracy with the Russian government. He made a political speech in an attempt to establish that Donald Trump had a right to react to the investigation in the way that he did. On the issue of obstruction, Barr said he disagreed with some of the case the Mueller report laid out as examples of obstruction of justice. We'll be discussing the main takeaways and reaction from our panelists. Our panelists today are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. We're going to actually have to skip our news headlines and go right into introducing and welcoming our panelists. Laura Carlson, Director of the Americas Program for the Center of International Policy, based in Mexico City. She's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Fortune, America's Updater, Foreign Policy in Focus, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura, welcome.
Thanks, Margaret, and greetings to listeners.
Okay, and Jackie Goldberg, who served in the California State Assembly, previously served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council before being elected to council. She served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. Welcome, Jackie. And Jackie, again, as our listeners may know, you are running yet again to be on the Los Angeles School Board, and I understand early voting has begun. Is that right, Jackie?
That's correct. Absentee ballots started coming out on Monday. If you have an absentee ballot and are voting for me, send it in right away. Don't let it sit on your counter.
All right.
Election is on May 14th.
Okay. And Dr. Gerald Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, has written more than 30 books, including his three most recently published books, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century, North America and the Caribbean, and Storming the Heavens, African Americans and the Early Fight for the Right to Fly. Dr. Gerald Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
All righty. So interesting times that we are living in right now. We're going to start out our discussion today by getting the reaction of our panelists to what's actually in the Mueller report. After we finish that round, we're going to be going on to discuss Barr's rollout of it and what he was trying to do and reaction to that. And then in our third round, we'll be talking about the new developments in terms of North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela, where John Bolton actually said that the Monroe Doctrine is alive and well. Well, there you go. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off now with a clip from the Washington Post and with what is in the Mueller report.
Attorney General William P. Barr released the redacted Mueller report on April 18th and announced his key takeaways. First, he said neither Trump nor the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to try to influence the 2016 election. And, his office concluded, none of Trump's actions rose to the level of obstruction of justice. However, at the time of Barr's speech, the 400-page report remained to be seen. Here is what's in it. While the Mueller team did not find evidence of criminal conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia, the report does reveal some previously unknown tidbits of information about the summer and fall of 2016. First, the report says the Trump campaign expected to benefit from Russia's interference activities. And it states definitively for the first time that Trump said this:
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
Just hours before Russia attacked the Clinton campaign's email system. The report also reveals that Trump asked people affiliated with his campaign to acquire those potentially damaging emails. On the question of obstruction of justice, what Barr said in his morning news conference is only part of what the report reveals. Mueller struggled with both the legal implications of investigating the president for obstruction and the motives behind a range of his most alarming actions. Mueller's team notably said it couldn't confidently say the president did not commit obstruction of justice. And the report reveals that the president didn't fully answer at least 30 questions from Mueller's team.
I was asked a series of questions. I've answered them very easily.
Saying he did not recall or remember or have independent recollection of information. The report also reveals that in May 2017, Trump quote-unquote lambasted former Attorney General Jeff Sessions for failing to protect him and recusing himself from the investigation. And according to the report, when he found out an independent counsel had been appointed, he cursed and said, "This is the end of my presidency." Barr says he will allow Congress to request less redacted versions of the report, and that might become a reality. Just minutes after the redacted report dropped, some Democratic lawmakers were unsatisfied.
All righty, there you have it. And some of the key findings, according to the Washington Post, of the Mueller report includes Mueller rejecting the argument that Trump is shielded from obstruction laws, that Trump, when told of appointment of the special counsel, said, "This is the end of my presidency." And that's a quote. Also, substantial evidence supports Comey over Trump in the account of the Flynn meeting, that the Trump campaign attempted to obtain Hillary Clinton's private emails, that the campaign expected to benefit from stolen information released by the Russians, that the Mueller probe spawned 14 other investigations, including two unidentified cases that remain ongoing, and that Putin stepped up outreach to Trump after the 2016 election. And the special counsel team concluded Trump intended to obstruct the probe in tweeting support for Manafort. And also, Mueller appears by a lot of, there's a lot of speculation on this, appears to kick obstruction, the obstruction question to Congress. He did outline 10 instances of obstruction, or what could be seen as possible obstruction, including the pressure on Comey to end the probe of Michael Flynn, of Trump's reaction to the continuing Russia investigation, the firing of Comey and the aftermath of that, the appointment of special counsel and efforts to remove, Trump was trying to remove the special counsel, and also to curtail the special counsel's investigation and to prevent public disclosure of evidence, and also making efforts to have the former Attorney General Jeff Sessions to take control of the investigation. You might recall Sessions had recused himself, and that Trump actually ordered the White House counsel to deny that he, Trump, had tried to fire Mueller, and that Trump's actions towards Flynn, Manafort, and other possible witnesses, and his actions toward Michael Cohen. So there's just a lot there. And Laura Carlson, we'll start with you. What jumped out at you, and what are your thoughts now in the aftermath, including the response, particularly from Democrats on the Hill? Laura Carlson.
I think the first thing that's obvious is that he was not exonerated. And so it's a far cry from the summary that we were given and all the crowing that went on in that space that was allowed between the summary, a misleading summary by Barr, and the full report that's been, well, the full redacted report, because that's an important part of it too, that's been released now. You know, Mueller was in, and he describes himself, in a difficult situation, a kind of a legal catch-22, because a sitting president can't be indicted. So what he said is, you know, a prosecutor's judgment that crimes were committed when charges can't be brought, and this is almost verbatim, you know, affords no adversarial opportunity for public name clearing before an impartial adjudicator, and therefore he felt it was not his role to bring those charges. But clearly he felt that there were charges, especially in the obstruction of justice volume of the report. But also, we have to remember that it doesn't say there was no collusion. What it says is that there's no evidence of conspiracy or coordination, or there isn't overwhelming evidence that would be that would initiate charges, which is a little different, because there's certainly quite a bit of evidence that there were attempts, or like you said, there were, they intended to try to use the Russians to influence the investigation. And I think that's another interesting part of it, that Trump was very fortunate in this case to have around him people who refused to follow his own orders. And that takes us back to Michael Wolff's book about the Fire and the Fury, about the rebellions in the White House. And there were actually some quotes in the report where, you know, Darren McGrun said, hello, the president is asking me to do some crazy stuff. He didn't say stuff, you know, and I can't do it. And there were a number of cases like that, and they were in part what eventually saved him from a formal charge on this. You know, there's still a lot to be found out. We are back to this no smoking gun situation. I think that based on this report, as we said last time, impeachment would be a waste of effort, and this is what Steny Hoyer has said in the House. Tactically, this is the conclusion that it seems the Democratic leadership has arrived at, and it seems to be a very reasonable conclusion. 18 months out from the election, what really has to be looked at carefully here is not the legalisms of what the charges were or were not, but the ethics of the whole thing. What we're clearly seeing is a president who made desperate efforts to try to suppress an investigation, who was very afraid of something, of a lot of things probably, within this report and this investigation, and said so clearly, and now it's on record, and who feels that he's above the law in many ways. That's really the takeaway as we go into the election period. I think it will be important for Congress to follow up on many of these points. That's been presented now clearly as its mandate. And in legal and historical terms, it's something that it has to do. In tactical terms, I don't think the Democratic Party is going to want to spend a lot of time and effort on the particularities of the report, except to indicate that we have a president who's acting in an authoritarian way, who's tried to protect himself from something, and that comes out very clearly.
Yeah, and Jackie Goldberg, also what jumps out at you, but also the reaction from the Democratic Party, because there is a split now in the Democratic Party. I mean, what Mueller, while mentioning that the president has a, quote, constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws, Mueller also said, quote, the separation of powers doctrine authorizes Congress to protect official proceedings, including those of courts and grand juries, from corrupt, obstructive acts, regardless of their source. So whether or not to use Mueller's damning, and I think it was a damning report, particularly, but not only, frankly, on obstruction to impeach Trump. I mean, it's a political decision. So there's this big debate of will the Democrats make a political decision given the 2020 election that's coming up, or will they do basically what many are saying their job is, that given what's in the Mueller report, he lays out a case of obstruction and indicates that it is up to Congress to make that case or not. So Jackie Goldberg, what jumps out at you, and also on this whole issue of the Democrats and impeachment or not?
Well, I think the thing that I haven't had time to read all of it yet, I guess many people haven't, but everything that I read always ends up with words like, and they lied about this, and they lied about this, and Sanders made it up when she said that the rank and file in the FBI didn't like Comey. She just lied about it. She made it up. And I think I'm overwhelmed by the number of times in the first part of the report that the report states that here are the documents down at the bottom with the emails and the phone calls and so forth, and it states down at the bottom of it many times over and over and over and over again, somehow, oh my goodness, they lied again. They lied and they lied and they lied. I think part of the problem for the Comey report was that there were so many conflicting liars willing to lie for this president that it was very difficult to be sure what was going on, because then he would find their emails, he would find their phone calls, he would find statements from other people about him. And I think that's the thing that most overwhelmed me as I was reading this, was the number of times he used the word, and then they lied, and then this one lied, and then that one lied. So that's kind of a worrisome, when you know that virtually there are a huge number of folks willing to lie for this man. That was the first number one thing for me. I think the next thing that jumped out at me was the dilemma that Laura just talked about. If you can't prosecute him, they said in the conclusion of the summary of Part 2, then we can't really make accusations, because if you make accusations, he can't defend himself without being able to go to court. And so, but I think the line that the most important line in the thing is in that conclusion, which is based on the facts and applicable legal standards, we're unable to reach that judgment. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. And I think that's what he's saying. He's saying, because of the Department of Justice's standing rule that you can't indict a sitting president, Congress, do your job. And he lays it out, man. He lays it out in 10 points. He gives them all the information they need, the legal framework for it he starts with. And I think, basically, the question that Congress has is not whether or not to be political. The question that Congress has is to continue to investigate. If they take apart the pieces that this report says, and they now have all kinds of documents that they did not have before, all of these phone calls, all of these interviews, all of these statements. I heard one pundit last night, and I think he was correct. He said, he quoted Churchill, who said that this is not the end, this is not the beginning, this is the end of the beginning. And that's what this really is. This report says that we have in the White House a person who does not believe that they need to tell the truth, that he can order people to lie for him, that he can hold them accountable if they don't lie for him. We have a person in the White House who does not believe that he is restricted by any of the checks and balances of Congress. I believe that there should be many more hearings, which are already planned by the Democrats, and I do believe that there should be an impeachment hearing, at least, which brings these charges. Whether or not they want to make that central to what they're doing, I don't think so. I think the most important thing to do is to keep playing those reports of which, I mean, I watched a couple of reports of people in Republicans in Congress who, when we were talking about Clinton being impeached, used language about much smaller items that said, of course we have to impeach him. You don't have to say that you're lying. You just have to lie. Well, we've got all the evidence of lies here. There's plenty of stuff here that needs to be done. But I will say to you, as a former government teacher for many years, if Congress does not hold the president accountable, if Congress does not hold the president accountable, and its only way to do that is impeachment, If it does not hold it accountable, we have no checks and balances in America. And no checks and balances means that you really can, honest to God, end up with something very close to a dictatorship.
Yeah, and Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, picking up on Jackie's point, one, we do want to know what jumped out at you, but on this point about what to do next, because it does seem that the Democrats are in a bit of a pickle. I mean, you have somebody like OAC already signing on, supporting Steyer, the millionaire, billionaire who's been calling for Trump's impeachment for quite a long time now, and we'll see how other progressive, in quotes, Democrats react to that. I mean, even Bernie Sanders isn't mentioning the I word now. Certainly Congresswoman Maxine Waters had been going on about it prior to the release of the report. I haven't seen a particular statement from her since. But the reality is, I mean, Jackie's point about if Trump is not held accountable, it seems as though the whole thing seems to be a bit of a joke. And could you imagine if a Democratic president were in office, let's say Obama was in office, and you had all of this evidence of obstruction against him, what would the Republicans do? Would they impeach or would they not impeach? So the other part of that that I wanted to say is that something to be considered is the Democratic base. You know, last time, a lot of reasons could be given to why the Democrats lost the election, Russian interference, voter suppression, etc., all of which are true. At the end of the day, also, a lot of folks just did not turn out to vote. A lot of Democrats did not turn out to vote because they were not inspired to vote. So are they now going to be inspired to vote if it looks as though the Democrats are just letting Trump slide and instead making a decision that if they don't impeach, that they stand a better chance of getting rid of Trump in 2020? Dr. Horn, I'm wondering what you think about all this.
Well, I'm afraid to say that the United States of America is now reaping the bitter harvest of 250 years of white supremacy and a century of anti-communism. About 1917 or thereabouts, the United States began this concerted campaign to oust communists from power in Moscow, succeeding in 1991, leading to the left not controlling the commanding heights of the economy and turning it over to oligarchs. As an adjunct to that policy, the left in the United States was seen as all too close to Moscow, and they were weakened considerably. And now we have the spectacle of the U.S. president being accused of being in bed with Moscow, with that prehistory that I just mentioned generally being ignored, and the 63 million strong Trump base basically standing with their man, not least because the preceding epic meant a weakening of left-wing trade unions, meaning a weakening of labor education, which has left them vulnerable ideologically, which leads them to stand by their man. Secondly, the Mueller report is very detailed about Russia. It mentions only in passing that George Papadopoulos, who was convicted, he, of course, was a Trump comrade, is suspected of actually being closer to Israel than to Moscow. And that raises the other question, which is that because U.S. imperialism plays such a major role in every nation on the planet, and because it has such weak campaign finance laws, many countries are interfering in the internal affairs of the United States of America. Look up Thomas Barrack, the Arab-American billionaire and close comrade of Mr. Trump, who reputedly and reportedly has been a conduit for Saudi influence into the United States and the influence of the United Arab Emirates. Congresswoman Maxine Waters is subpoenaing the documents of Deutsche Bank of Germany, a major financier of Mr. Trump, and those documents may reveal why Mr. Trump has been so harsh towards Chancellor Merkel in Berlin, perhaps seeking leverage in his dealings with Deutsche Bank. With regard to Mr. Mueller's contention that he could not indict because of this Office of Legal Counsel finding in the Justice Department that a sitting president cannot be indicted, I think that if you look at that opinion, it rests upon a weak legal basis, and I was surprised that Mr. Mueller did not challenge that. It may be one more example of how he blinked at the end of the day. In any case, I think we should also await the Inspector General's report, that is to say the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Michael Horowitz, who's investigating the investigators. As a historian, I would like to put both reports, Mueller and Horowitz, side by side before I come to definitive conclusions. And in any case, it's on one of the key issues, that is to say the Ukraine, and Paul Manafort, the Trump campaign chair, now in jail and defrocked, supposedly being a conduit for pro-Moscow influence in the Ukraine. What's striking is that the Democrats, as has been their habit of late, are running to the right of Trump on many key foreign policy issues. You see this with regard to North Korea, and you also see this with regard to the Ukraine. Mr. Manafort was trying to push the Ukraine in a center-right direction, sympathetic to Moscow. The Democrats, and now Mr. Trump, who has capitulated to their policy, is pushing neo-fascism in the Ukraine. There are so many issues involved in this report and in this present crisis, but sadly enough, I'm not sure if the country as a whole, not to mention its pundit class, has the ideological chops to deal with it.
Right, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are now in terms of moving forward, because the general thought is that the only way to really see the evidence in the report, because we've seen how Trump and his team, in fact, his outside lawyers actually saw the report even before members of Congress, even before members of the Intelligence Committee. I mean, that itself says something. So they had time to look at the report and get their reaction together and likely help to shape that Barr's comments that we'll go to next, Barr's rollout. But some are saying that the only way to really get those documents is to start at least some kind of impeachment hearing. If not, the parties that be could just say no. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this position the Democrats are in now about a political decision, allegedly, of not to impeach, right? Or I also think it's a political decision to impeach. So one way or the other. Dr. Horn, any thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that the Democrats holding majority of the House can get an impeachment resolution through the House. The problem is that it would die upon arrival in the Senate because the Senate, or that is to say the Trump base, would not allow the Republican-dominated Senate to remove their man. Certainly, I think that Chairman Nadler of the House Judiciary Committee needs to hold far-reaching hearings. He needs, obviously, to bring Mr. Mueller himself before that body. And at least the continued digging may reveal and expose more secrets that then the progressive movement can use to its advantage.
Yeah, and just one other thought on this, Jackie Goldberg. Dr. Horn is absolutely right because the votes are not in the Senate. Speaker Pelosi has said that any impeachment proceedings, she would want to be bipartisan. It does seem, though, that perhaps more information can come out to the public, including getting documents that Congress does not now have, further evidence in an impeachment hearing than not doing an impeachment hearing. Any quick further thoughts on this before we go to station break?
What I said when I quoted Churchill about this being the end of the beginning, I mean that just sincerely. As hearings get held, both in the two major committees, you're going to find that more and more information is going to be public. You're going to hear from Mueller himself. You're going to hear about why he keeps listing each section in the second part of the report as evidence. He calls it evidence. He doesn't call it information. He calls it evidence.
Right.
He calls it first, and then he has an analysis that calls that this is an obstructive act because, okay, they have written a plan that says here's what you can do if you want to pursue obstruction of justice. You have Graham who said about Clinton that you don't have to actually do anything wrong. You have to just have the intent, and we know by what he said that his intent was a cover-up. Well, if he used the same standard, he would be in charge of calling for impeachment for this president. So what we have is a failure of the Republican Party to act on behalf of the American people. And that will only become clear as more and more evidence is brought forth. So I think those hearings should be public. They should be televised. They should tell people everything. They should bring in all the witnesses. I was impressed with this report, even with redactions, by the amount of documentation. I'm just looking at page 140 of the second one. It already is up to 968 footnotes. This report details what they did, and it tells you how they know they did it. So this is not a document that says, oh, President, you did nothing wrong. We couldn't really find anything wrong. It says, we found unbelievable amounts wrong in this chapter two of this report, and we can document it, and we can tell you, here is what the evidence is. Here is our analysis of why this is a obstruction of justice. And I believe that the Democrats have a responsibility, whether they can get the impeachment finalized or not, to bring forth this information. If they don't want to do it through impeachment, they must do it through hearings, through bringing in witnesses, by having Mueller testify both publicly and then publicly and privately in some of the committees where there's issues of national security. But this cannot just stop here, or otherwise we've told the President of the United States that he is above the law. He does not have to worry about being held responsible for his actions, that he can tell his people to lie, that they can continue lying to us. I mean, if anybody believes anything that Sanders ever says again, they will be, they should be indicted themselves for some crime. I mean, there's so many places in this report that talk about what she lies. She just makes stuff up at the table. You know, we have a situation where the government is out of control. And if the Democrats refuse to take that on, and I don't believe they will, I think they will take it on in the most responsible way, which is through these committees they chair in the House. That will decide whether or not there's impeachment.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that, Jackie Goldberg. And some breaking news here. The U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler has officially now issued a subpoena to the Department of Justice to hand over the full report. So we'll see what happens with that. And I assume that means unredacted report. What we're going to do now is to take a short break. And when we return, we will talk a bit about this U.S. Attorney General who is functioning more like Trump's personal attorney and the rollout that he did, giving really a false impression of the Mueller report. And then after that, we'll be talking about John Bolton saying the Monroe Doctrine is alive and well, new sanctions on Cuba, on Venezuela, and Nicaragua. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs.
The late, great Bob Marley's Redemption Song. This is Margaret Prescott. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And you could check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud. And all of our back shows are archived there. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. Let's do across the United States. We do have in several cities across the United States SoundCloud listeners, and internationally, let's give a special shout out to our SoundCloud listeners north of the border in Canada, particularly in Saskatoon, Canada, where we have quite a few listeners there. It is our weekly roundtable. Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn, and we're discussing discussing the Mueller report and the rollout of the report by Trump's pick, who was then confirmed by Congress for the U.S. Attorney General, who replaced Jefferson Sessions, who had recused himself from the Mueller investigation. Let's start out now with a clip on one from Washington Post and another from Time Magazine on that incredible press conference that William Barr held even before anybody, Congress, well, not anybody, because the White House and the president had already seen it, but certainly before Congress and the public, where he basically made a justification for Trump and also said that he disagreed with parts of the Mueller report. Let's go to those clips now.
The special counsel's report goes on to consider whether certain actions of the president could amount to obstruction of the special counsel's investigation. The report recounts 10 episodes involving the president and discusses potential legal theories for connecting those activities to the elements of an obstruction offense. The Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. There is substantial evidence to show that the president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency, propelled by his political opponents, and fueled by illegal leaks. Nonetheless, the White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation. The Office of the White House Counsel requested the opportunity to review the redacted version of the report. Following that review, the president confirmed that in the interest of transparency and full disclosure to the American people, he would not assert privilege over the special counsel's report.
You say to people who are concerned that you were trying to protect the president.
Eric.
There's interest in the absence of the special counsel and members of his team. Was he invited to join you up on the podium? Why is he not here? This is his report, obviously, that you're talking about today.
No, it's not.
It's a report he did for me as the attorney general. He is required under the regulation to provide me with a confidential report. I'm here to discuss my response to that report and my decision, entirely discretionary, to make it public, since these reports are not supposed to be made public. That's what I'm here to discuss.
Impropriety for you to come out and sort of what appears to be sort of spinning the report before the public gets a chance to read it.
Okay, thank you very much.
In assessing the president's actions discussed in the report, it is important to bear in mind the context. President Trump faced an unprecedented situation. As he entered into office and sought to perform his responsibilities as president, federal agents and prosecutors were scrutinizing his conduct before and after taking office.
Well, there you go. The other thing that was notable about Barr is that he kept repeating no collusion. And actually, collusion isn't even mentioned in the Mueller report because there wasn't a charge to look into collusion. But that was just repeating Trump's political mantra, really. And Laura Carlson, he repeated it at least five times and gave a very political rollout and justification of this while saying that he disagreed. I didn't think it came out in that clip, but he did say that he disagreed with some of the obstruction of justice case that Mueller made. Now, he had neglected to mention that in his first rollout some weeks ago. That would have made a big difference, actually, and also, in a way, misrepresenting the Mueller report on the issue of obstruction. So I want to just give us your feedback on all this. I personally find it outrageous that taxpayer dollars are paying for this guy and he's functioning like Trump's personal lawyer.
Outrageous was exactly the word I was thinking of as we were listening to that clip as well, because this is a man who is in what is the highest office of the country for law enforcement and legal interpretation. And he's speaking like a campaign manager in everything that he did. And it was carefully calculated. You have the initial one, which basically says there was no collusion, as you mentioned, never even a charge. And there was insufficient evidence for obstruction. And then he leaves this period of time in which this misleading, totally misleading summary allows the press and everyone else, you know, to establish the narrative that Donald Trump wants, and then we begin to find the actual facts, which completely belie the original impression that was given to us. So, you know, I think it's outrageous. It's very, very dangerous to have such a partisan and a biased individual in charge of legal proceedings within the country and setting law, and it's really unacceptable. So there's been calls for his resignation. There's been calls to get him out of office, and I think that they're fully justified. What we see in this is that there is a lot of information to go on now that could hopefully make this period up to now, which has been filled with misrepresentations, irrelevant in the sense that we can now begin a much more fact-based analysis of what's going on. I'm not one of those people who believes that the issue that the United States interferes with elections or that other countries interfere with U.S. elections, it makes this less important. I think that there is, I agree with Jackie, that we have to go on with the hearings. I think that it's a big step forward. I think that this is a very, very important report for the history of the United States because if other countries, you know, have been interfered with the United States by the United States, they should take up similar investigations. The Kremlin saying that there was no meddling, and we see extensive information on meddling. And self-determination and free and fair elections are key to representative democracy, which is what we have. And we have to evaluate what really happened there.
Yeah, and
Barr is clearly an obstacle.
Right, and Jackie Goldberg, I mean, looking at Barr's history, he's been on the wrong side of history, whether it's in the past on mass incarceration, on immigration, on the separation of church and state. He covered up the people in the Reagan administration who did illegal activity in the Iran-Contra scandal. He's been his issues on racial profiling and more supporting secret military trials, etc. So he comes to this job with that kind of history. And I think it was Chuck Schumer that said that his press conference was a campaign press conference for the president. But to me, it really makes hay out of the what is put forward as the separation of powers in the federal government. And I think there's a real danger that people are increasingly going to be disillusioned by what Laura Carlson just referred to as this democracy in this nation, seeing how all of this will be handled. Jackie Goldberg.
Well, you know, when you have an attorney general approved by the Senate, that everyone knew who he was when they approved him. And I think that was kind of the problem. So now I think if you really want to talk about impeachment, I'd start with him. I'd impeach Barr. He made certain commitments. He made certain commitments in his hearing about his fairness and justice and looking at it openly. I remember watching his testimony before the Senate when he wanted to be approved. He has lied about almost everything he said. He is the communication director for the campaign. That's who he is. And he's made it very clear that's who he is. I think the biggest outrage is holding making a conclusion that there was no problem with anything that the president ever did in his whole life ever was his statement to the Congress, as what Mueller said. And there was no problem here, no problem there, nothing to see, nothing to view, and we'll get it to you just as soon as we can. They intended, this was a political decision to give the president victory laps for weeks prior to anybody seeing what actually was said. Not the first time the guy did this. He misinterpreted intentionally last time he was asked to interpret something when he was in the position he is in now in a previous administration. So what we really have here is a commitment by the highest and most important and usually the most apolitical person in an administration, which is the person who is the head of the Attorney General's office, that is the Attorney General. What we have here is a person who has made it very clear that he is not a person that represents the Department of Justice, that he represents the president. And if the Congress does not take up that issue in investigating his lies to them when they were, and they won't, because, of course, the Senate, Mitchell will say, well, we can't do that. It's not relevant. So we need to move on. It's time to move on. Well, you know, it isn't time to move on when your country's in danger. And your country's in danger when a chief officer of justice is not a person who is informed by justice in his opinions.
Absolutely. And Dr. Gerald Horn, we do want to hear from you about Barr and the rollout and the significance of what that might mean, not only for the country, but the example the United States is setting around the world. But before that, because there's a link here, I think, with another dangerous member of the Trump administration and Trump himself. And I want to go to a clip of the rollout of John Bolton talking about new sanctions on Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. And then, Dr. Horn, you can comment on Barr and then take us into the final segment where we'll be discussing the international matters. If that's okay, Dr. Horn, let's go to that clip now.
The Trump administration is proud to announce several further measures we are adopting to reverse the consequences of the disastrous Obama-era policies and finally end the glamorization of socialism and communism. We are also announcing that the Department of the Treasury will implement further regulatory changes to restrict non-family travel to Cuba. These new measures will help steer American dollars away from the Cuban regime or its military and security services who control the tourism industry in Cuba. We will also be announcing new limits on remittances to Cuba. We know that families in the United States want to help their loved ones in Cuba, and we want Cubans to get the support they need and deserve. For this reason, our new limits will be $1,000 per person per quarter. This afternoon, I'm also pleased to announce new sanctions against the Central Bank of Venezuela to restrict U.S. transactions with this bank and prohibit its access to U.S. dollars. The Central Bank of Venezuela has been crucial to keeping Maduro in power, including through its control of the transfer of gold for currency. These steps against Venezuela's central bank should be a strong warning to all external actors, including Russia, against deploying military assets to Venezuela to prop up the Maduro regime. The United States will consider such provocative actions a threat to international peace and security in the region. Today, we proudly proclaim for all to hear the Monroe Doctrine is alive and well. In the past few months, more than 50 nations have joined the United States in recognizing President Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. The walls are closing in. There is no turning back. The people will prevail. And when they do, we know that Cuba will be next. And soon thereafter, we pray, the third member of the Troika of Tyranny, Nicaragua, will also at last be free. Today, I am pleased to announce that the United States will also sanction Bancorp, the Ortega slush fund. This is just the beginning. As long as the people of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua stand for freedom, the United States will stand with them.
All righty. So, Dr. Horn, I mean, it just seems to me as though on the one hand, on the domestic front, there you have Bob Barr, and on the international front, you've got John Bolton. As far as I'm concerned, Barr and Bolton are cut from the same cloth. I mean, this is really scary stuff. The Monroe Doctrine, U.S. foreign policy beginning in 1823, that basically said the United States could have control over all of the Americas, pretty much, not only within its own borders. So just your reaction to Barr's rollout on the one hand, and on the other hand, what the scary stuff that we're hearing now from John Bolton. And you might also want to comment on the developments happening in North Korea, Dr. Gerald Horn.
First of all, with regard to Barr, the question is, why did so many Democrats confirm him? This is of a piece with their past practice, for example, confirming late Supreme Court Justice and reactionary Antonin Scalia by a vote of 98-0 with all Democrats present voting in favor of him. I think it's also important to look at Mr. Trump, as many pundits have suggested, as a kind of crime boss. The problem is that he's so incompetent that if this were to be a Hollywood movie, it would be pitched as Goodfellas meets the Three Stooges or The Godfather meets Dumb and Dumber, which means that he's even more dangerous than he appears to be. With regard to Cuba, which will the U.S. latest maneuver will allow more lawsuits against property losses by exiles in South Florida post-1959, I would hope that Canada and Britain respond by authorizing lawsuits for those of Canadian and British heritage who lost property post-1776 when they were expelled and expropriated from what is now the United States. Certainly, Canada and the EU are upset with this latest maneuver. You might have seen that Prince Charles himself was in Cuba just a few weeks ago, which I think sent a loud signal to Washington as to what direction that London is leaning as we speak. I think it's also a bit of a puffery on the part of Mr. Bolton, because he and most observers realize that with a reported 18,000 Cuban troops in Venezuela, it's going to be more than a notion to engage in a military intervention. And so, therefore, he's left to these press conferences where he's reiterating the emptiness of the so-called Monroe Doctrine. Likewise, with regard to North Korea, the latest news is that the DPRK has supposedly developed a new weapon. The Republic of Korea, South Korea, is quite concerned about this. Chairman Kim reportedly will be heading to Moscow next, and that will further constrict, it seems to me, Washington's efforts to effectuate an entente with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Yes, and Laura Carlson, we just have about, what is it, about three and a half minutes, so maybe between you and Jackie Goldberg on this whole issue of John Bolton's announcement in relation to Venezuela, Cuba, and also Nicaragua. I had also heard somewhere there's a rumor floating around that the United States may very well invade Venezuela by the end of this year. Laura Carlson, quick thought.
Well, this is warmongering. The sanctions themselves, there are already so many sanctions that some people feel that they're not a huge difference, but the rhetoric is accelerating, and then we have these constant rumors, actually, of invasion as this looming threat in order to put behind some of these measures. I don't know if other people found that the clip cut off a little bit, but essentially, just to really quickly say what these sanctions are, the most important ones have to do with the Helms-Burton Act against Cuba. And basically, it says that U.S. citizens can file lawsuits for properties confiscated in 1959, which, as the historian on our panel has pointed out, could open up to historic measures that would be completely contrary to what the Trump administration thinks it's doing here, you know, going back to Native Americans, for example. But what the real problem is, too, is that this is going to alienate allies. This is considered a unilateral extraterritorial measure. The Helms-Burton Act has always been that, that affects a lot of U.S. allies in a very negative way. And then the travel restrictions are major, too. They think that they're trying to get in good with the Marco Rubio alliance. They think that they're going to try to affect Florida politics. I think they're misreading Florida politics. Second-generation Cubans do not have this warmongering attitude toward Cuba. They have a very different attitude. So it's probably going to be shooting themselves in the foot as well.
All righty. And Jackie Goldberg, I mean, note the attack on not only the Obama administration, but on socialism, which clearly is, you know, an attack on people like Bernie Sanders, frankly speaking. And just your quick thoughts on these moves now, undoing decades of practice in relationship to Cuba.
This is a great gift to Cuba. Cuba has been modernizing since there's been influence. Once the United States begins having relationships with it, those people that travel there, people who go there. There's been change already beginning in Cuba. This will stop it completely. And the reason it will stop it completely is because everybody needs to remember that Castro offered to buy all of the latifundias at the price that the owners of those properties declared on their taxes, and they refused to accept that money. That's when it was seized. So there was an offer to buy, but the offer to buy was at a rate that was determined by what people lied about what their value of their property was.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing for people to remember. Secondly, it's important to understand that when they talk about the land being taken, it wasn't just the large farmsteads, but it's also the house you might be living in, because all the property was taken after people left and fled Castro. So what you have is now everybody who lives in any place in Cuba now has to worry that somebody in the United States will say, well, that was my house, and sue them for it. Well, that immediately helps the current regime stay in power. So I think that this was a stupid move designed, as Laura said, to affect Florida politics. But the effect of it will be, I think, quite the opposite.
Okay. Thank you, Jackie Goldberg. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank all of our panelists. We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our team, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our audio engineer, assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. A special note. As many of you may know, there is a huge crisis going on in Haiti with massacres continuing. The Sojourner Truth team was there a week and a half ago. I'm afraid I have to return urgently to Haiti, because something has got to be done going down there with a delegation. So we're going to have special programming for you next week. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
That's why I'm here.